Hey cousins, you were listening to Revolutionary Hood Rat with Kim Young, a dope black social worker, and welcome back. I am recording and editing this particular podcast on National Cocktail Day. So happy National Cocktail Day, which is March 24th. And I got up this morning and I told myself, look, if you do all your chores, including wash your hair, record the podcast, edit the podcast, do a couple of things you need to do, like with content creation, then you can go do hood rat shit. Like, you would have earned the ability to celebrate National Cocktail Day. So here I am practicing discipline. And instead of running out the house to go do what needs to be done, I said, I'm going to get some things done like a responsible adult. So here I am. So let's go ahead and jump right into this episode. I want to start with some revolutionary news because we got some for the week. Shout out to the Payment for Placement. So if y'all are not familiar with the Payment for Placement, it's a student-led movement that is occurring on college campuses across the country, organized by social work students that are pushing that they are paid for their placement, for field placements. For anybody who has gone through this process, we know that not only do we're not providing free labor, we are literally paying to provide labor, right? So we are paying tuition to provide labor because it is required that you complete a certain amount of field placement hours in order to obtain a BSW or MSW degree. And so we literally be out there like working real hours, y'all, doing real work. And above all of that, like a lot of these agencies and organizations, they are getting kicked back. Like they get paid for a lot of the work that social work interns provide, especially if it's Medicaid reimbursement, funded work. Like it's absolutely wild when you think about the amount of unpaid labor that social work students provide to these nonprofit organizations, government entities, private companies. And so shout out to all the students and the faculty that support them, organizations that support them, because we need to really show that we care through paying social work students for the labor they do provide during their field placements. So shout out to the Payment for Placement movement. And if you want to learn more, I encourage you to tap in and support the students the best way that you know how, even if it's just getting curious about their circumstances and situations. So let's go ahead and jump right into the episode that we have for the week. And obviously we have a guest because we still rounding out Social Work Appreciation Month. So let me go ahead and introduce our guest for the week. Stevens. Ashley Stevens is a licensed clinical social worker born and raised in the great Buckeye state of Ohio and now nestled in the beautiful Queen City, also known as Charlotte, North Carolina. Ashley is known as a dementia guru online, where she spreads her wisdom and knowledge. You might be asking, how did dementia become her life? Isn't dementia for older people? Well, not quite. Because at the age of 6 years old, she was introduced to Alzheimer's disease as she watched it take a toll on her great-grandma Charlie and her entire family. Decades later, she found herself organically in the midst of the dementia world by collaborating with families. And at this point, she refuses to look back. She sees this as not only her job, but as her passion and as her calling. I'm excited to be able to contribute this conversation, offer it up for folks to learn from, glean things from, get curious about. Let's go ahead and dive into this conversation with Ashley. Enjoy. All right, Ashley. Oh, I'm so excited to be able to be in conversation with you because this one's been a long time coming. I don't even know when I had sent that DM, but it feels like it might have been January or something. And we were finally able to find a date to have this conversation. And so welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I know you have been busy, which is an understatement. And I remember you said in our communication that you would look at a date further on into March because you were teaching, right?
Yes, I started teaching this semester. My first adjunct professor class that I'm teaching at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. So,
Oh, so you in Queen City?
Queen City, baby.
Listen, I'm going to tell the story again. I've already told the story before because I had Alicia Alicia on the podcast. I had one of my friends ask me, they was like, Kim, when we going to Queen City? My ass. I was like, that a strip club? I had no idea.
No, man.
I had no
Queen
idea.
City. Charlotte. They say Charlotte, no L-I-T.
Charlotte. Lit, like lit, because y'all be litty, especially when CIAA used to be down there.
Right.
So, yeah, I am. So then we are literally cousins and neighbors, right? Because I'm right up here in Virginia. So thank you so much for hopping on the podcast with me. Like with everyone that joins, I really want to start in that place of like, what got you into the field of social work? How you get here?
Yes. So I always start with sharing how I actually got introduced to like aging and dementia, because that is really my heartbeat. I was very young. I was only 6 years old. And my great grandma Trolley, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, which is a type of dementia. And I remember visiting my great grandparents and being in the home and hearing some really strange sounds coming from the back room. And so, you know, me being the little curious kiddo that I was, I went back to see what's going on. So as I'm getting closer, I'm hearing screams, I'm hearing crying, I'm hearing laughing, and I'm just like, what is going on? So when I get closer to the room, I peek through the door and I see my great grandma Trolley on the bed fighting. I mean, pushing, kicking, screaming, hitting my mom and my grandma, who were trying to assist her with care. And so at 6 years old, I had no clue, you know, what that actually meant. And it was actually really scary, like just that image of seeing her like that, that was not the grandma Trolley that I was used to. And so at 6 years old, that was like my first encounter of dementia, Alzheimer's, and caregiving, to witness my grandma and my mother trying to provide the best care that they could for her. And so that was like my first encounter. And then fast forward to college and young adult life, I started to take on the class and some different classes in gerontology. That was not my major initially. It was speech pathology for children.
In undergrad? And,
yes, in undergrad. Ah. And I was not, you know, I was not doing the best. And my advisor was like, okay, so this is what you really want to do? And I'm like, I don't know. So I took a gerontology course and just immediately fell in love and just started to connect some of those missing links too. Like, this is what my grandma was dealing with. This is Alzheimer's. This is dementia. Like, I didn't know, you know, from all that time, I didn't know what she really was dealing with. And so being able to start making those connections, learning about aging across the lifespan, I had a really good professor, Dr. Nancy Orrell. She was also the director of the program. So she like invited me to come volunteer and start, you know, engaging in the aging field. And that's where I just fell in love and felt like, okay, this is home. Like, I would go to some of the local nursing homes and assisted living and go visit with the residents and just go knock on their doors and just go sit and talk with them, do Bible study on Wednesdays, just, you know, really getting to know them and getting to hear their stories. And it felt reminiscent of my grandparents, my great grandparents, right? So again, feeling like I'm back home, like this is right. And so then fast forward again, I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, because I'm originally from Ohio. So, yes, OH.
Listen, be proud about it, because I don't be hearing the best thing coming out of Ohio. So be proud about it.
This is true. This is true.
Right, so, young yes, city.
Yes, I moved because I wanted to, you know, I'm young, I wanted to explore. And then I knew I wanted to go to grad school. So I was finishing up like my last credits of my degree, and that was my internship. So I came to Charlotte during my spring break with my parents. They drove me down and I did some interviews at some different internship locations. And the one lady, she was like, so you mean to tell me you're here during your spring break interviewing for internships? Like,
because you knew you wanted to go to grad school when you were still in undergrad?
Yes, I knew that. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that that was kind of the path. And I knew I didn't want to do that in Ohio.
Okay.
And so I had a few different cities that were like my favorite, but Charlotte was one of them. And so I set up some interviews. And she was saying, you know, shouldn't you be like out having fun or something on your spring break? And I'm like, Yeah, but I have a plan here. Like, I need to get this decided quick, okay? So she actually ended up becoming my mentor and my internship supervisor, wonderful woman. And so I moved down to Charlotte, and then she connected me with a licensed clinical social worker. So that's the connection to social work because I still didn't quite know what I wanted to do. And gerontology, is a similar like helping field as well. So it was a perfect path. And so whenever I shadowed her for a couple of days, I was like, okay, this is good. Let me learn some more. So I went to the UNCC, U University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I went to their open house. And when I went, I was kind of searching for, okay, where are the gerontology professors, right? Where are the gerontological social workers? And I landed on one, and he was like, oh, you need to come to our program. You need to come because, there's not enough of us. I was like, oh, really? Like, you guys don't have a track for aging or anything? He's like, oh, no. But we try to talk about it in some of our classes, and I'm the only professor, but we need you. And I was like, okay, sold, So I did my MSW at UNCC, and I remember actually the day that I graduated, my family, they all came down from Ohio to celebrate and support me. And then the very next day, they sat me down and they said, great, congratulations, this is wonderful. Now we need you to put that degree to work because your Nana has just been diagnosed with dementia. So here we are again. Now, 22 years old. I'm no longer that young 6-year-old. And
And they put all that
dementia.
pressure on you.
I mean, kind of. And it was at breakfast. We were at the hotel, and I was like,
Listen,
what's going on?
I'm bringing that up because, like, I'm not going to attribute this to just Black families, but it is something about, I don't know about you, but I'm a first generation college student. So once you start accumulating degrees, they just automatically assume you a doctor, no matter what you went to school for. Like, but you can solve
Right.
all the problems in the family. Be like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. I just learned all this stuff, right?
Wait a
Like,
minute.
I don't know. And of course, like the shock of hearing that my
Nana,
Nana
yes,
Jeanette,
indeed. Yes,
now she
indeed.
has dementia. And now
Yeah.
I know what that means. Now I know what that
Yeah.
diagnosis means, and I know what it means for my family. So that's also jarring and just frightening still. And
Yeah.
so they fly me back home. We set up a whole family, meeting, and I bring in some resources, Alzheimer's
Yeah.
Association, in-home care, just trying to get everything together because my family is a large family. So this is my dad's side, and so he has 9 other siblings. And so getting everybody on the same page, family dynamics, family working together, which they did amazing. I work with a lot of
Wonderful.
families,
That
and
is
they
just tough.
did
The
amazing.
acceptance part be the hardest piece of it all, much of the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Acceptance, and then kind of, care. I like to think of caregiving as just like this big old pie, and kind of divvying it up by pieces. Like, okay, who's going to take this piece of the pie? Who's going to take this piece? If it's the financial piece, who's going to do that? If it's the in-home care, who's going to do that? And really assigning those care roles so that it
Yeah.
doesn't fall all on that person, on one person, or that person who is actually living in the home
Yeah.
with my Nana at the time. So, a full circle moments, my great grandma, my Nana, going to school, getting my gerontology, getting my MSW, marrying those two degrees together. I think it's not a coincidence. Like, my
At all.
path to here is not a coincidence. It is my legacy. Like, I don't just talk about dementia and aging and these issues because it's fun. Like, I also have Like, I feel led to do this work, and it's because of my great grandma, it's because of my Nana, it's my why, it's why I show up every day, and why I don't give up, because dementia is not easy
Yeah.
either. Some days are harder than others, and so I'm reminded of my why, and why I'm in this field.
Yeah. And even listening to your story and thinking about the other stories that I've heard from Black folks in terms of like how they found their way into the field of social work, hearing another story where somebody didn't set out to become a social worker, but like social work fell into their life, like it kind of was a landing spot to be able to do their work, but not so much the destination that they had in mind. And I really noticed that in many of our stories, when we talk about how we entered into this field, we didn't enter into the field with a goal of like, I want to be a social worker. More or less saw social work as like a place where we can come and do the work we were already doing or the things we were already passionate about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I think that's a great point.
Yeah, I think it's really cool, which is why I love being able to talk to other Black social workers about how they got into the field. Because when I was going through my challenges of trying to figure out and determine if I even belonged here in the first place, because, you know, we learn a lot of things in school. We see stuff in our programs. We see stuff throughout the curriculum. We're in field placements that give us every other message of like somebody like me does not belong in this work, right? But the more I kind of talk to other Black social workers, it's like, oh no, like we always belonged here, but we just didn't really have the words or the language for professional social work, but like been doing the work. Yeah, we come from a legacy of helpers and doers, and we just landed in this field of social work. And so even when you think about moving from Ohio to Queen City, that's not a strip club, but an actual location. When you think about moving from Ohio to Charlotte to begin your social work program in your own journey, what were some of the experiences or challenges and lessons that you encountered throughout your social work education?
So, you know, my social work, like my classes, the program, the school, all of that, it was a pretty good program, honestly. Just, and probably also too, because I didn't start, like you mentioned, I also didn't start out in social work. So my MSW was new to me, even though there were some, you know, similar themes in gerontology, social work was very new to me. And so, the program itself was pretty good. The students, you know, there were some times where there were differing opinions, and, you know, especially when you're talking about some of those hard topics like privilege and things like that. But I also kind of, I was used to that. Like I grew up in a household where my mom, she was also in academia, and she was over the diversity, equity, inclusion department, multicultural services. So she would always come home and share those stories about how people challenge those topics or challenge talking about white privilege and those issues. And so I already knew how to kind of move around some of that. And get what I came here to get, which was my education. So there were, you know, some of those just challenges within the classroom. But again, I was really intentional about my learning. I really wanted to soak in every possible opportunity that was presented to me during my social work program. So I, you know, worked as a graduate assistant. I also worked full time outside of that. I traveled to Africa. I was a part of the first cohort in my MSW program that went to study abroad in Africa. And so there were a lot of different opportunities that I wouldn't have experienced outside of my social work program. Mm-hmm. So I always say, like, my degree is not like a degree, like, oh, congratulations, you got a degree. It was life-changing for me. Like going to Africa, going to Malawi was eye-opening and shifted my perspective and thinking and my worldview completely. Yeah. And so I credit a lot of that towards my program as well. But I, as far as challenges, I think most of my challenges were more personal challenges, like just the stressors of a high course load, workload.
And internship hours.
Yes, internship where you're not getting paid. Yes.
And still working, like you mentioned, like many of us are working while also working for free. Yes. Not even working for free, we're paying to work because you're paying tuition to them to be placed up somewhere to give them free labor.
Exactly. Free labor, working for free, in internship. And then doing grad assistant work because I'm like, let's work some more. I don't know, you know, just, but you know, the challenges of also paying your bills because you're
big
also
bills.
out in the world as an adult now. So nobody else is paying your bills. And
Big
I was
bills.
by myself. I was single, living by myself. I moved, like I said, I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina by myself. And so I really had to foot all the bills and take care of myself. And so I was doing that multiple ways. And let's get a degree on top of that, you know? So a lot of different things I was into. And the stressors of that got to me. The first time that I actually took advantage of utilizing therapy was in my graduate program. That was the first time I ever saw a therapist because I was like at my breaking point. And I had just come back from Africa. And I was like, how do I live in this world, in this, you know, American culture after what I've just witnessed? I don't want to be here, right? I don't want to live
in this. You were speaking
this.
My language. I said, not with us having similar experience, because in my graduate program, we had a chance to go to Ghana. Black social work students, and we went to Ghana for about 3 weeks, had some of the same thoughts. And I was like, how do I come back to this shit after being there? And not just being there and experiencing there, but being able to engage with Black social workers in Ghana. And when I was exposed to and taught how the way social work functions in Ghana, it's not even about formal systems of care, like social services. Like, it's literally community taking on roles of these systems that are over here oppressing the hell out of us. And I was like, how do I come back to America where they care about time and punctuality? I wasn't even upset that I had to wait 3 hours to eat when I was in Ghana. I had so much grace and understanding.
Yes. And like when I actually came back to the States, I was like, I don't even want to go out to eat. Like that's, I had guilt. Like, I don't want to overconsume. Like I felt guilty in some of
that.
The traditions and culture and the ways of
that.
Life that we do here.
Being able to flush toilet paper.
And having a bed to sleep in and, you know, just really appreciating those things. And like you said too, understanding their culture and not systems, but community. Community care, family care. You know, I was so excited to meet with the grandparents of the villages and talk with them about how they care for one another. They care for the children care for them. Yeah. So then coming back to the States where we have families that can't get it together when they're providing care for a loved one, I'm like,
this don't make no sense.
So I dealt with that and said, okay, I need to get into therapy because I don't know where to place this. I want to come back and do good. I don't know how to do that. So I need to like process this, and I need to also get my thesis and capstone completed to graduate.
Right. Because you understood, like even hearing you kind of share about how you were able to ward off with what I believe like many social work students with minoritized or racialized identities experience, like you being able to ward off a lot of just the nonsense for a couple of reasons. Like one, you were prepped in your home, right? So like it was a part of just your conditioning inside of your house. But then also you had this understanding of what you were going to grad school to do.
Right.
So like you knew what you want to study, the courses, the track that you were on. And there's so many folks who kind of land in these social work programs knowing they want to help people. They want to do something, but they aren't quite clear on who they want to help and how they want to go about doing that. And social work programs do not do the best job of helping to guide students and figuring that out. And even when I think about my own program, and I'm grateful for the way it was structured, even though they didn't do a good job of letting students really understand the comprehensive nature of the program. We had like four tracks in our MSW program, and one of them was geriatrics. Had a whole geriatric track.
We still don't.
We had a double major program. Like you can go get your JD and your MSW at the same time. So a Juris Doctorate and an MSW at the same time. Had an MPA program, an MSW program, and an MPH. An MSW program. And so like my school had all these like dope tracks that you can take, but all they really told us is you got to pick macro or micro. And I was like, you mean I could have been getting my JD, because I probably would have done that. I could get my JD and my MSW at the same time. I didn't know that was possible.
I know that was possible. And so school comes with its own set of challenges, just the academic rigor of it all, but also the emotional labor that it takes to be a few amongst many, learning about a lot of the things that we're exposed to in these social work programs. But even beyond that, like you taking this real specialized approach in gerontology and with geriatrics, and from the outside looking in, it don't look like it's a lot of folks that look like us in that work. And even in like the research that contributes to how that field is understood and taught and how folks are then treated, right? Like in the gerontology space. And it could just be my perception of just not really knowing what it's like on the inside, but then also the exposure that I've just kind of had to nursing facilities and assisted home health care, or even when I was at the working at the hospital on the gerontology unit in the psych ward, right? So who was in charge? Who was making decisions? And it wasn't somebody who looked like me that was in charge of making decisions. Now, providing the care, absolutely.
Right, because we're going to be a CNA, huh?
Absolutely providing the care. But being able to kind of be in a more like powerful decision-making position, not so much. And so I would love to be able to hear from you just some of your experiences and even the jobs you've had and your career progression in the gerontology geriatric space.
Yes. So, I actually, when I moved down here, I started in long-term care. And so that was assisted living, independent living, and memory care, all housed in one building. And so, like you said, did not see people who looked like me in leadership roles.
Right.
And so this is me just getting my undergraduate degree in gerontology, just trying to like find my way. So I started in activities in the programming department and working in independent living.
Oh, I know, and that was fun. You playing their activities? Oh, because they love to have a good time.
Yes. I mean, Wind Down Wednesdays. Yes. Okay. We had bingo on Fridays. Right. I called the bingo. But I mean, bingo is serious. Okay?
They don't play about bingo. You better not call them cards and them numbers.
Listen, the prizes for bingo.
Play about that.
We had to get some very extravagant prizes. Now, everybody don't like bingo, so I'm here to also say that not all older folks like bingo. Let's
correct.
Be clear.
Correct. Some like Pacino. Some also like Pacino.
And some just want to dance.
That's
we
it.
Have socials.
Yep. Yep.
We would have, like I said, we'd have wine night. We would have nails that we would do, painting nails and things like that. So planning activities was tons of fun. But I also noticed that there was a gap. There were programs and activities that were missing in the memory care neighborhood. And that's where I felt led to go down there, because it was in the back, right? Off to the side, to go down there, and I say that in quotes, and provide some type of engagement and interaction, because sometimes when you would go into the neighborhood, there was nothing going on, you know, and it just needed to, you could tell the residents were desiring some type of interaction.
Absolutely.
And so that was where I like, you know, spoke up. I would love to be able to focus my energy and time in the memory care setting and work there. And so I was doing a lot of that while I was getting my MSW. And then when I graduated, that's when I got promoted to the manager over that neighborhood. And so that was, you know, doing programming, but also now staffing and training staff and managing a whole neighborhood of folks and families and all the things. And so that was, I worked there for about 6 years, and it was, yes, a long time. And it was such a great experience. It was so hard. When we talk about challenges and joys, like that is a perfect example of a job where there were tons of challenges every day, but also joys, because here I am, I get this great honor to sit alongside folks who are living with dementia, walk right alongside them and help them navigate this very difficult space, that their environment, their day-to-day activities. I felt like that was a privilege to be able to do that, to come into their home and support them through that. And so I loved it until it just became too much, you know, when it's just like, okay, staff calling out, I'm on the floor, I'm doing showers, I'm doing everything, and it feels overwhelming. And I'm like, okay, this is not the end for me. Like, I have to go somewhere else, I have to move up at some point. And so after leaving there, I went to work in nonprofit. And I worked, which is an experience too, right?
Tell me about it.
And I went to work at the Alzheimer's Association. That was like the dream for me. I was like, oh, if I can work at the Alzheimer's Association one day, I've made it, right?
That's one big old corporation.
Right. And the local chapter was so small. And so how many social workers did they have? You take a guess.
Probably just you.
Just me. And I mean, doing everything, support groups, family care consultation, 24-hour helpline during work hours, I was on the helpline. And those calls are extreme, right? Folks are calling in, talking
like in a crisis, they're called?
Talking about the challenges of caregiving for someone with dementia, talking about the stressors as a caregiver. Many caregivers dealt with suicidal ideations and just the lack of support that they would express, that they weren't receiving from family, from friends, from their community. And so it was definitely a taxing role, a great role, because again, I still had the opportunity to work with caregivers and people living with dementia. And I think the biggest shift for me was that when I worked in long-term care and memory care, that setting, it was very siloed. It was very, you know, segregated from other aging and dementia organizations. And so all I would see in those settings, it was people living with dementia at the moderate to advanced stages of that diagnosis. And so needing assistance with bathing, needing assistance with grooming, toileting, eating, all those things, all the way up until their last breath. Like I've been with residents who took their last breath, right? What an honor. So that was kind of my very small view of what dementia was. So when I came to the Alzheimer's Association, it was a big shift, because then I was able to work with people living with dementia in the earlier stages, which I had never seen, that where people are working still, they're driving, they're making their own decisions, they're making their wishes known for when they get to a place where they advance in the dementia diagnosis where they can't make that decision. And they're speaking at national conferences, they're advocating, they're telling their story. It was just so empowering to be around that, because that is not what I had witnessed for the past, you know, 7 to 8 years, where I was, you know, volunteering and then interning and then working in that setting. And so that definitely was a big shift for me in a good way, in a great way.
Yeah.
And then where I am currently, I'm in government now. So that is the Department of Social Services. But I actually interned at DSS when I worked at, or when I was getting my MSW. And I remember saying, oh, I'm not going to be working there. But, you know, great experience, right? You want to have the experience.
I interned there as well my first year in my MSW program.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is great, but I'm not going to work there because I don't want to do that. That's not what I want to do. And so when the program that I'm in now came up, it's a unique program. Again, I'm the only one who's doing it, and it's kind of housed in social services.
Yeah.
So I cover a whole territory, not just one county. And so it's focused on dementia, caregiving, all those things, aging, not like what the other social workers are doing. So it fits me very well, but I am back in the Department of Social Services. And who would have thought?
But you know what? But I love that you brought that up, because there are some people who don't understand the full scope of the Department of Social Services, wherever they might be. A lot of folks just get it kind of stuck in the child welfare or family welfare.
Right.
Surveillance policing system, whatever you want to refer to it as. And many people don't even know about the adult component, right? In terms of, a lot of people don't know about adult protective services and the caseworkers and social workers that work on those cases. Mm-hmm. But in many localities, but also the way you just shared your story, it's not too many of them that are actually on that side of social services, but we continue to see an increase in the mistreatment and miscare and abuse of adults that are suffering with intellectual disabilities, memory loss, dementia, whatever, physical disability, whatever that may be. And the population continues to age. So we are having more older people living longer.
Living longer, that longevity. Yes.
Living longer, who are dealing with, who are invisible in a lot of people's minds. And I'm thinking about my time at a nonprofit, and one of the programs that I was in charge of was our older adult program. They don't call me no senior. I say, I'm going to call you what you, whatever you want me to call you. So it was the older adult program. And a big part of that program was to decrease social isolation amongst the older adults in my community. Because a lot of them are living by themselves in homes, and they like to have a good time. They want to come together. They want to be in community. They want to support each other throughout the transition and the end of life.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so even we are dealing with older adults who are also raising kids, like raising their grandkids, who are like starting their whole cycle of parenting and caregiving when they should be able to go through their own process of aging and transition. And so it's really interesting when you think about what a caregiver looks like these days. It isn't always somebody's birth child, chosen child, their niece, nephew, whomever. You can have older adults being caregivers for each other. Like, I just want to be able to provide some context, because I want you to also speak to the isolation of caregivers, the stress that caregivers are experiencing when they are in these positions. And many times it's not by choice.
Right.
To be a caregiver to someone who is struggling with dementia or just going through the aging process.
And I love that you said that too, because a lot of times caregivers don't even identify as a caregiver. They don't even say, raising my hand, I am a caregiver. Like, they don't even understand that all of the tasks and the roles that they've taken on, that's caregiving. And so that's a huge part of, you know, my role too in the education component, educating the community, educating folks who are in those roles that, hey, you are a caregiver. Let's talk about what that looks like. And let's talk about resources that you might be able to plug into because you are
to get paid to be a caregiver.
right. But yes. And I also, before I talk about the stressors, you talked about grandparents raising grandchildren. Yeah. And that is what my capstone was on.
Okay.
That is such a challenge for a lot of older adults. And then I was always interested to, you know, see more research on what happens when that grandparent is caring for their grandchild and then they begin to experience some cognitive decline. Okay. Then there's this role shift, right? Now the grandchildren are caring for grandma, hopefully, if they're even able to
be age.
Of age, exactly. So thank you for highlighting that. And the majority of grandparents raising grandchildren are Black women, right?
And that's, you know, that's what it is. I mean, we're intergenerational for much of the way we either we're housed together or we're in proximity to each other. The same way you gave an example of a caregiver that can raise her hand and be like, hey, I'm a caregiver. It is naturally assumed. This is what you do.
Yes.
Because we often, like, we may joke about it, and there are probably some data points somewhere, but like, we don't end up in retirement villages and homes at the same rate as like white people do.
Oh no.
We don't do that.
Well, that's like the promise I made to mom and dad. I will not, you know, that's what a lot of our people say. And sometimes that promise, especially when we talk about dementia, sometimes we have to let go of that promise because the weight of care is heavy.
Talk about
it. And I'm always specifically talking about dementia. It is not just, people confuse it and think that it's just simple forgetfulness. It is not. It is that individual losing capacity and functioning on a daily basis. So losing the ability to do something so simple as brushing your teeth, knowing the steps that it takes to pick up a toothbrush, put it in your mouth, and brush your teeth. It gets down to, you know, even the very minute steps of completing a task like that, like bathing, like going to the bathroom. And so then the caregiver, they assume all of that. They become that physical body for their person. So it's taxing on them physically, and then emotionally, that stressor also is attached to it, because now the anticipatory grief that comes with it, right, anticipating when this diagnosis is going to shift, because it's going to shift, it's going to transition to something more difficult. So anticipating that, anticipating when this person is going to pass away, and yeah, already feeling like they're no longer here because they're not the same person they used to be, and seeing your loved one change. So it doesn't feel like your mom anymore. It feels like you're caring for someone else, right? Mm-hmm. And I won't say, I know a lot of caregivers would say role reversal, or feels like I'm caring like they're my child, which they're mm-hmm. not. But it feels that way. Some of the tasks that you're doing, it feels like it's more of a childlike state that they're in. And so dealing with losing that relationship, losing that identity of, okay, this was my mom, but now my mom doesn't even remember my name. Like, mm-hmm. I just talked with the caregiver about that yesterday. Like, how do we work through that? How do we process that? Because that, in the scope of the diagnosis, that's very normal. That's yeah. that's usually going to happen. Not
Shit
always,
still
but
hurts.
It could.
I know
it still hurts every it's time, okay. Not just the first time, yeah. every single time it, yeah. for it's years. Like, yeah. It's mm-hmm. another cut. And so really helping caregivers to process some of those stressors so that they don't, you know, burn out. They don't have compassion fatigue. They yeah. don't. Have outbursts on their loved one, because that's so common with dementia where, okay, I just told you this. Why are you asking me that again for the fifth time? Mm. Not remembering that they don't, that part of the brain is gone.
Can we stop right there? And I want to stop right there mainly because I want to introduce, I don't want to talk about Wendy Williams at all, but I don't know how caught up you are with the new Wendy Williams documentary that came out. Like, Where Is Wendy Williams? That kind of highlights, I don't even know if highlights the right word. I think it exploits.
I haven't seen it. It came out already?
Yeah, it's a four-part documentary on Lifetime, and it's called Where Is Wendy Williams? Because, you know, the diagnosis came out about her with, what is it, prefrontal dementia and aphasia or something like that. I don't know the official term.
Frontotemporal dementia.
Thank you. Yep, and then aphasia. And that documentary essentially exploited her, how unwell she is and has been, and the people around her that were not supporting her at all. Like, still trying to push her to do things like start a podcast and trying to put her in the public light when she is literally unraveling in front of the camera. And so there was this very popular piece of promotion that was running to, like, you know, hype up the documentary, when Wendy's driver and her her PR person, they were taking her to the tobacco store to get an e-cigarette. And Wendy literally had, people would call it a tantrum, but if you understand what is happening, he is forgetting that this is where she has been coming for like the last 5 to 6 years. And everybody has been explaining to her, like, no, this is the same one. The lady keep going inside and bringing her the wrong e-cigarette, going back inside, bringing the wrong one, but it's actually the correct one. And she is like breaking down, making them drive back around the block to try to prove to herself that she has the answer and she knows what's happening, when she really does not have an understanding of where she is, what she is attempting to accomplish, and how the people in the car are just frustrating her because they're trying to convince her that
They're trying to push it.
Yes. And so I'm bringing this story up because there's been like this discourse online about like dementia, that the way this kind of phrase is, dementia doesn't make you mean. That's the way, like, they were like, dementia doesn't make you mean. If she's behaving like that, her spirit was already bad. And I'm just like,
oh man.
Especially if her part of dementia is the deterioration of that frontal lobe, which is like all the things you need for processing information.
Yes. Yes.
And regulating behavior and emotion. I was like, I think it might have something to do with dementia.
Yeah.
And so if you can speak to that for a little bit, if you feel comfortable, it's like the behavioral changes that can occur in
yes.
someone's loved one.
Yeah, that is very common, and especially with a frontal temporal degeneration diagnosis, FTD for short, we'll call it FTD. FTD, like you mentioned, it's impacting the frontal and temporal lobes of the brain. And so those lobes of our brain, like you said, processing language, processing, you know, how we communicate objects, how to use objects, the meaning of those objects. So this pen here, I think that it's for me to eat with now because I don't remember that it's a pen, right? So it's being able to understand that, make sound judgment, that part of the brain is deteriorating. Mm. And the interesting thing that happens when those brain cells die off, they never replenish. And wow. So it's not something you can build back up. It's not something, oh, you can keep quizzing her and she's going to get it. No, it's not there. And so with FTD, we see the behavioral symptoms of the diagnosis more challenging. Outbursts sometimes. Sometimes it can be a safety risk for that person and for their caregiver. And I always mention there's a podcast called Remember Me Podcast, and it's two of my friends. They are caregivers, FTD, dealing with that for their parents, and they bring on other FTD caregivers to talk about some of the safety risks and some of the very bizarre, I mean, bizarre just experiences with the behavioral symptoms and the changes and the up and down, the police in and out, because it's just so mm-hmm. extreme, because that part of the brain is losing its capacity and ability to make sound decisions, and it becomes a safety risk. Now, I say that, but that does not mean that diagnosis for Wendy or for me or for anybody is going to look the same. The one right. thing we do know about dementia is it is individualistic. It does not yeah. look the same for everybody. And I guess I want to bring clarity too. FTD is just one type of dementia. There are several different types of dementia. Dementia is just kind of like this umbrella term, a general term, and we mm. have different types that fall underneath that umbrella. FTD is one of them. Alzheimer's disease is another one. My Nana Jeanette had vascular mixed dementia. Mm. Different types of dementia impact different parts of the brain. Treatment, medications, things are going to look very differently. Again, with FTD, there's going to be more behavioral symptoms and challenges experienced by that person. And so I'm heartbroken to hear of that documentary that you're talking about. I do want to watch that so I can, you know, learn more. But yeah, and the other thing is, you know, caregivers, people in her camp, people who were in that documentary, it reminds us that they need education. Because they don't have a clue. And a lot of people are uneducated about dementia and they're in denial, right? So they're going to try their darndest to bring that person back. Like, oh, you remember
nothing was wrong. They were like, everything is fine. You're still the same person. You can get back in front of the camera and the mic. I'm like, no.
Forcing it and believing it. And then here's the tricky thing, the sneaky thing about dementia is that there's days where there's moments of lucidity and that person is clear as day. And it's like, mom is back. No, don't get it twisted. Mom is not back. She's just having a moment of clarity, and let's love on that and accept that for what it is. But that does not mean that she now no longer has dementia and she's going to remember every single thing that you need her to remember. And so you telling that about the documentary kind of sheds light on the need for education. And especially those who are actually going to be a part of her support network and her caregivers, they need to be equipped with the right tools so that they can support her, not create an environment where she's failing, where they're setting her up for failing.
Drinking, not eating. Yes. She was drinking something terrible, the wine, the vodka, not eating. I was like, this is not helping.
Wow.
Not helping.
And then two, the pressure that, you know, don't you remember you got that is.
And
not
you're the one that
the
makes
brain.
The money for everybody?
Oh, well, that's true. They got a stake in it, right?
They got a stake in it too. Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the honor of being there when somebody takes their final breaths, right? And they transition. And I want to speak a little bit just about death and dying, especially just amongst the Black community and Black people. Generally, this is not something that we like to talk about or plan for, death or dying, right? But, and I would say the last year or so, I've been working to get real comfortable with the idea of dying and death, not just my own, but like my mom's, right? So it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And I remember I just got done watching the Dear Mama documentary that was about Tupac's mom. And I had finished the documentary and I looked at it and then started crying. I was like, Kim, and I said it out loud for the first time ever. I was like, Kim, your mom's going to die one day. I know. Right. That was my first time ever saying it out loud. But then like I sat with that, I let myself feel all of that. Mm-hmm. And then from that moment, I've really been working to improve my relationship with the idea of death and dying. So then when the day gets here, I'm not under the house and I can't function and I can't, you know, figure out how to go on with life. Mm. And so I want to just take a moment just from your experience of being with a family and the person, right, throughout their during their transition and throughout their transition. What are some of the things that you are hearing, even if it's around just the stigma or the way we can support our loved ones during their moment of transition and when they die? Because it's going to happen.
It's going to happen. And that's something we all have to remember. So thank you for that reminder. Actually, I had this conversation with my cousins maybe last week, I think it was, like, oh my gosh, I just got off the phone with my mom for 2.5 hours. And what happens the day I can't do that?
Like, exactly.
That's going to come. And I cannot even fathom it because it's like, that would take me to the core, right? But it's the reality. And being able to sit with individuals I work with and their families during that very intimate moment is so sacred, so special. And you learn too. You learn about the dying process and what that looks like and how, again, how intimate that is. And how the family grieves through that, how they handle that, how you support them through that. So I do kind of miss being able to still be in that space and work with families through that process. I have a friend who is actually a death doula. We hear about birth doulas, but she's a death doula working in hospice. And really, that's her role, is to help those families through that process and understanding, you know, what the breathing looks like and what that, why that's happening and how to support your loved one through that and how to accept it, right? And not to force feed and give them food when that might help make them aspirate, right? So really unique type of work and special work. But as far as within our community, I think it is something we shy away from. We shy away from the conversation of death and dying, which then in turn makes us shy away from planning for our death and dying.
Okay.
So, you know, having the paperwork, having our advanced directives in place, having a power of attorney, having a will, all those things. Because we're so secretive and so, you know, tight to the chest, and we don't want to talk about these things, then we don't have it planned out for when it is our time. And then our families are scrambling to try to do the best that they can to honor your wishes that were never known. And so I think that is a huge to do in our community, in our Black community, is to open up the conversation and begin to talk, even if it's not, you know, how do you want to die, or how do you, you know, sometimes those conversations are too rough,
too direct.
Sometimes we can just talk about, you know, what would you prefer if this happened? Or who's the person who's closest to you, who you would want by your side through a challenging moment? Let's not even talk about death. Through a challenging moment, who's that person that would be your number one go-to? And then start writing those things down. There's this there's this really fun game that I played with my, it was my Black African-American caregiver Alzheimer's support group that I facilitate, we played this game because we wanted to have conversations with our loved ones about end-of-life planning. And the game, I think it's called the Hello Game. Yeah, Hello. And it's talking about end-of-life, but in a more lighter, fun way. And it has you asking some of these questions, like, what is your favorite song? Like, what song would you want playing if you were taking your last breath? Yeah. Like, some of those kinds of things that are lighter. And then you write it down. And then by the end, you have your advanced directives in your hand, right? So that's a more lighter way, a lighter tone to set the conversation and have that conversation with your family members, but know that it has to be had.
It gotta happen.
We are not having it enough, and then we're setting ourselves up for failure.
Yeah.
And I think too, it's also just when we're thinking about stigma, it's also the fear of dying.
Absolutely.
The fear of aging, the fear of dying. I say this a lot. We live in a society that honestly just hates aging and hates to age and is very ageist. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of that sometimes is factored around the fear of death and dying mm-hmm. and what that looks like, or the unknown. And so the more we create space where we can actually talk about it and bring down those walls, especially with our family members, we should be able to do that with our family members.
We should
members
be able to do it, because right? We end up in, like, you can joke about it too. It's a serious yes. conversation, yes. but the shit is also kind of funny when you start thinking about, like, what you want to make sure we eat at your repast. Like, yeah, who you want to, what color you want us to wear? Who don't you want to show up? You know what I mean? Like, all of these questions need to be, I think they need to be asked, because we also have to recognize that death is a industry. It's a business in this country. And true. Folks don't want to really think about it through both ways. Yes, it hurts. It's going to, you know, it's going to hurt, but it's natural and it's going to happen. It's supposed to happen. Dying is supposed to happen. And right. death is an industry in America. Meaning it costs a lot of money to be dead.
Yes, in tons. America,
right? Tons. And so how we can be able to have this conversation both ways. I'm going to miss you. I love you. I want to make sure that we can honor you the way you want that to happen. And it's going to cost us a lot of money to get this done. So how about we think about planning this in the most effective and efficient way? Mm-hmm.
I love that.
And I know for some people that's hard. Yes. Yeah, for some people that's hard to recognize, but when you think about all the Black families that got to scrape together some money to buy a headstone, scrape together yeah. some money to get the documents and deeds and all this kind of, no.
Or GoFundMe.
Or GoFundMe to be able to lay their, you know, their loved one to death, to, I mean, to, mm-hmm. to well, an interment. Like, we as a people, we got to get more comfortable with this conversation of aging. We age.
Yes. Yes, we age. We which age. Is a great thing. If you're not aging, you're dead.
Hello? Okay, we want to age. Aging is an honor. We're going to die in transition, which, as yeah. you talk about, is an honor to be present in those moments when it happens for people. Mm-hmm. And what I have come to recognize in my own work, especially from accumulating a lot of, like, 79-year-old best friends, 82-year-old mm-hmm. best friends, is the ones that I have had and have in my life, they have reached this place of peace when it is time for them to transition mm-hmm. and die. And at that point, they just want to make sure the ones that around them are okay.
Right.
But the moment right. that the loved ones and the care, you know, caregivers and kids and families can let that person go, that's typically when they transition, like right. be holding on for other people. And so right. I think on the other side of, like, the survivor side, there's a lot of guilt when you are wishing someone to stay here, but it is mm-hmm. honestly time for them to go.
Give that permission.
Ready to
go.
Yep. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so how we as a people can just have that conversation more fully and with each other, I want to be able to see that happen, because that goes back to the community stuff that we talked about from our experiences in the countries mm-hmm. we visited mm-hmm. in Ghana, right? Like, we are born in community and we die in community, which means you should be able to talk about how these things yes. happen with each other yes. and support each other.
And I also think too, you know, if it's tough to start the conversation, start it from your absolutely. Perspective. Like, hey, I want you to be my person. I need to make this decision. I'm getting some things together for my advanced directives for my will, I wanted to share this information with you because we should have that information. We should already have the information for ourselves and be talking to our people so that they can execute it when it's time, whether that's a trust, whether that's a will, whatever it is. We need to have that conversation. So if we start with ourselves and say, hey, I'm planning this, I'm getting this together, these are my advanced directives, can you help me? That might then encourage or plant the seed for that other person to then say, well, yeah, I need to be thinking about this too. Thanks for bringing that up.
I took my parents to go get all their documentation last May. I said, let me tell you something right now. You're not going to have me stressed out when it is time to plan what needs to be done. We even had the conversation about why my dad served in the military. He telling me he want to go be buried in the at some military cemetery. My mom was like, oh yeah, and I'm gonna go over there too. I said, well, I'm not coming. I was like, I'm not coming. Visit y'all at no cemetery. And I even had to say to my dad, I was like, all that foolishness you told me you dealt with in the service, you want to go rest your body next to the people.
Right.
I didn't think about it like that. I said, let me tell you something. We're going to get cremated. I'm going to take you on vacation and I'm going to let you go.
I said, that's right. You got it planned out. Yes.
That's our plan. So then I will have this belief that like y'all are all around me and you're not locked in some ground somewhere that I'm never going to come see you. But to be able to work myself, to be able to have these conversations with my parents, I'm grateful. And I want to be able to help support other Black folks in particular to be able to have these conversations with their parents because they need to be had. Right. They need to be had. I'm going to get you out of here with two more questions. They're two of my favorite questions to ask folks. First one I definitely have to ask is around this hood rat shit because, you know, I'm on a quest to just like reclaim what that means for us. And it can mean a lot of stuff if that's like watching Lifetime Channel movies, doing yoga, cooking. Mm-hmm. Twerking at brunch, I don't really care. But like when you think about how you show up to pour back into yourself, what does hood rat shit look like for you?
Honestly, for me right now, which I shared with you earlier, is being able to give myself permission to rest.
Yes.
Being able to rest and also being able to be around the people that recharge me, that help to, you know, make me feel like I'm restored. And those are like my close people. I'm a little introverted, so I don't need a whole big group of folks, but the people who I trust, the people who are closest to me, my husband and I, we do date night every Saturday. Sometimes that looks like, oh, we're going to the beach. And sometimes that looks like Fortnite in the living room with a movie and pizza, like whatever we want to do. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that brings me joy, that restores me. And then, like I said, giving myself permission to rest and to not do all the things all the time. Like, it's okay, Ash, to just take a nap. Like, I grew up in a household where that was not okay. Like, you need to be doing something. You need to be up. You need to be working. And now, like, I've taken that on as an adult. And it's time to, like, dismantle that, bring that on down to size. We are not lazy if we take a nap. We are not, you know, all those things.
There's no way we can be lazy. That's what I've been trying to tell people. When I think about the legacy of Black people, Black women particularly, there is impossible. No way.
Impossible.
There's no way we can be lazy.
No way. So yes, giving myself permission to rest and just be me, do me, like show up as my authentic self. Like that took years of like not trying to be something, not trying to talk a certain way, not trying, just being Ashley. And I think it's also, I'm an Aquarius, so I feel like it's a little bit of the Aquarian in me. Like I just do what I want to do. Like, don't worry about me. I'm going to be doing my own little thing. And just, that's fine. You know, I don't have to follow the trends. I'm just going to do me. And so giving myself permission to do me, show up as who I am and love that, you know, walk in that confidently.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. My last question for you, and I asked this question to continue to encourage other folks in this work to think and dream about their life beyond it. Like, we don't have to do this forever. People know I am not doing this forever. I have an exit date. I don't necessarily have an exit plan, but I do know I will not be practicing as a social worker beyond the year 2030, right?
Yeah.
And so even when you think about yourself, when it's all said and done in terms of what you have come and contributed to this work and the way you have known it, how do you want to be remembered?
This is such a great question. And it's also like, oh, such a big question, right? It's like, ooh, this is a tough one because I feel like my job is not done in this space yet. There's a lot of work to be done. I know that I'm not the only one doing it, and I can't be the only one, but I still feel like I've got a lot of work to do before I retire from social work, like you say, and retire from gerontology. But I think the legacy that I want to leave is just to embrace aging, to embrace the aging experience, the aging process. I know I talked a lot about the dementia guru and dementia and caregiving, but my other like passion is also talking about ageism and disrupting ageism. And I feel like that's something we can all relate to because as we're sitting here right now, every single breath that we take, we are too aging.
Aging,
It's not something
absolutely.
that we arrive to when we turn 65. We are aging too. It's not them or them over there aging. It's us, all of us, we. And so I would love to leave that legacy of embracing and accepting your own aging experience, owning that. And empowering yourself, not letting others empower you, but empowering yourself to love who you are at any stage, any age that you are, and to speak to that, to help others to also speak to that, because then that helps us all to dismantle, disrupt ageism and be in a society, in a community that embraces our age. Say your age out loud. That's okay.
Be proud about it.
Be
I absolutely
proud.
love that because them jokers be having a good time. I know you said, we're breathing, we're aging in this moment, but I think about my homies that I used to work with. They used to love taking field trips to DC to go visit museums. They just wanted to be in the hotel. And I said, don't y'all do nothing I wouldn't do because taking a group of older adults on a field trip is like taking a group of teenagers and college students on a field trip. And
Listen, they turn up.
I need people to understand that you should give yourself permission to fully live throughout your entire aging process.
Live,
Live all the
claim
way through
it.
it. All the way
Don't
through it.
be ashamed. Don't be ashamed of your age. There's no such thing as anti-aging. That is not real. Claim your age, own it. Because here's a fun fact. If you don't, and if you live to, despise your age and have this internal age bias towards yourself, you decrease your life and your longevity by 7.5 years. So it's time to shift that thing, and it's time to embrace it and help others around you to also embrace aging.
I love it. I love it. Well, Ashley, how can the good people get in contact with you or be a part of your community online?
Yes, they can follow me. My handle is at the at sign, the Dementia Guru. And then they can find me on Instagram, Twitter, sometimes LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Ashley Stevens. And then my website is www.thedementiaguru.com. Reach out to me to partner, to build, and to do speaking engagements and
To
all the fun
pay.
things.
To
Oh,
pay.
because listen, we're not in a space of offering free labor. We are not. We are not. Okay. Thank you, but no thank you. Okay.
Understand. I am so grateful that you hopped on here and shared these jewels in your wisdom with me. I learned so much and with those who will ever have the opportunity to listen. And I thank
Thank
you so much
you.
for all that you do. But also just like who you are and showing up authentically in the work. Like that's dope.
Thank you. I appreciate you too. You showing up and the platform that you have, it is making a difference for future social workers and current social workers. Like your platform speaks to us. So thank you for doing the work too.
Oh, I appreciate that, truly. That was a good conversation, right? Like I'm hopeful that you were able to gain something from the wisdom, the tools, the knowledge that Ashley shared. Let me think. A good black word for the week. What is a good black word for the week? Actually, even reflecting on the conversation that I had with Ashley about elders and older adults and just the aging process, it reminds me how little we do not know.
I mean, how little we know, right? Like how little we know and how quickly we forget that people have lived many lives before us. And that's just me kind of thinking and being in community with other folks in my age group and younger and older, how little we do not know, but how quick we are to assume that we know a lot. And not just know a lot, there are some people who are out here behaving in ways like they know everything. And when we behave like we know everything, how dangerous we become to ourselves and other people. And so what it feels like the good Black word is shaping up to become is, don't ever get to a place in life where you feel you cannot receive the wisdom and the knowledge from others. And also, we must be cautious not to exclude and push our elders out of our world, right? Like, we cannot push them into isolation. I believe we have to continue to embrace and feel their warmth, their love, and their knowledge and their energy, and be able to keep that with us. We can glean from it, learn from it, but also pass down the wisdom and the stories and the ways of our elders to future generations. Like, this is how we don't lose recipes. This is how our history continues to grow and carry on, because much of who we are, and I'm speaking specifically to minoritized and racialized people, much of who we are is not captured inside of books and articles. It's captured within elders and stories. And so we have to be open and connected with them. And we must remember, we really don't know shit at the end of the day. And that there are people who are around us that have lived many lives, and they have much wisdom to offer if we remain open to receiving it. So there it is. That is our good Black word for the week. Y'all, thank y'all. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for all the things and all the ways that you continue to support me. I can't really put it into words in this moment in time, but as we close out Social Work Appreciation Month, this has been a good one. This has been a good one. Thank you for showing up for me for the webinar series. Thank you for tapping into the podcast and the conversations that I've had with some other phenomenal social workers in this game. And I am excited. I think that's the word I'm going to go with. I'm excited and I'm hopeful and I'm focused and I'm determined to see where all of this goes. Where all of this goes, because we all go in there together, wherever we end up. So that's all I got. So thank y'all, thank y'all, thank you. Truly, truly, truly. And as always, please remember to take care of your heart so that we can take care of each other, because at the end of the day, we all we got. The people is all that we got. And I will holla at y'all next time.